We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which company has been recorded, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. We respect their continuing culture and the past and present contributions they have made to this region. You're listening to Company, the podcast connecting Australian artists, where we talk all things personal, professional, and spiritual. Joining you, as always, are your hosts, Georgia Kennedy and Tiana Catalano.
Hello and welcome to our third episode of Company.
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
I thought we'd get to episode three.
I did. I had a feeling.
Yeah, no, I had a feeling as well. I was hopeful. But this week we have a very special episode for you because technically we're kind of, you know, connecting Australian artists, but we were given an amazing opportunity to talk to Jonathan DeMar, who is an American producer who just won a Tony Award for Hadestown. And we were like, oh, we should probably take that.
We should absolutely talk to him.
I think it's really important that we kind of have a listen to not only what happens behind the scenes with producers, because I have no clue about it. I do now, but didn't before. But also having an idea of how it works over in New York and how we work here and how that kind of happens between the two, how the shows come over and whatever.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was super insightful and he was just such a lovely open man.
Yeah.
So great to talk to him.
So great. So thank you. Shout out to Michael McCall for setting that one up for us. It was amazing. But yeah,
It was amazing. So we're going to hop into that interview very soon. But before that, Tiana, I think it's time for a little riff. Do you want to do a riff for us?
A riff of the week?
No, just a riff.
Just a riff.
A singing riff.
Oh. May I just intercept there and say, yes, we realize it's not really a riff of the week because we have fortnightly releases, but we have an announcement. that we are actually going to be having a double release. So this week we have our special edition, then we have a bonus episode, and then we have our normal episode after that too. So it will be technically a riff of the week for the next 3 weeks.
Hell yeah.
Let's go.
When are you ready?
Okay.
Riff of the week. Riff of the week.
So my riff of the week is great. It's The Great, starring Nicholas Hoult and Elle Fanning. It's on Stan. It is so funny. It is set in Russia, sort of in the late, I want to say, 1500s. I could be extremely inaccurate with that, but that's not really what it's about. It's about Elle Fanning, who is trying to overthrow Nicholas Hoult. It's so funny. It's very feminist. The themes that they talk about and the way that they talk so candidly about sex and death and war and violence is quite abrasive for me as someone who doesn't really like watching violent shows. I really enjoyed it. I devoured it in 2 or 3 days. If you want a laugh and if you want to say huzzah for the next month just in your day-to-day life, I'd recommend you watch The Great.
Huzzah!
Huzzah!
I can agree. I've only watched one episode and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was so good. I'm not going to talk about The Great, though, but I will talk about Disclosure, the documentary on Netflix that stars Laverne Cox. And I watched it after hearing her interview with Brené Brown. And I guess, like, yeah, it's just so educational to see, like, through history how transgender people have been represented and thought of. And I just had, like, kind of like a light bulb moment where I kind of thought, you know, going to parties as a young person, boys or girls, mostly boys though for some reason, would always be kind of gratified or celebrated for dressing as the opposite sex, and it always used to be such a funny thing that we could do. And I was just kind of like, wow, that was just wrong. Like, and I guess like we've always kind of been pushed to be either one or the other, and I'm really really excited for the future when we don't do that anymore and people can just be free to dress however they like and they don't have to be confined to these, you know, societal norms. And I think it was really, really interesting to see the overall picture of how we represent transgender people in media, because it ain't fair. Like, it's just not. And Laverne Cox talks about how Orange is the New Black was kind of a step forward for their community. And yeah, it highly suggests. Very educational, very inspiring. And yeah, it was great.
Amazing.
Yay. Side note, for my recommendation, Georgia got her history very wrong. It's actually set from the late 1700s when Catherine the Great was Empress of Russia. My apologies.
Jonathan Demar began his journey in the arts when he was 7, making his Broadway debut in A Christmas Carol. Since then, he has worked in the business both on stage and behind the scenes. On TV, he has appeared on Comedy Central, The Onion's News Network, and The View. Demar has also recorded for both The Sugar Beats and Camp Broadway.
As a producer-investor, he has been involved with various shows, including the West End revival of Gypsy, Broadway's Love Letters 2014 revival, The Cripple of Inishman, starring Daniel Radcliffe, 9 to 5 the Musical, and most recently won a collection of Tony Awards for Hadestown the Musical. Hello and welcome to Jonathan. Thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Hey guys, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no. Thank you for talking to us. It's insane. And whereabouts are you right now?
I am in New York City. So, yeah, in the Big Apple, which is a little different these days. But it's been a nice kind of time of reflection and just doing things I normally don't do with the downtime and all. So it's been great. And you guys are in Australia, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I think we're exactly 12 hours apart.
Yes.
So Georgia and I are currently sitting in Whopper at uni at 10:04 at night and it's the morning for you.
I know you guys were so gracious when I was like 10 a.m. and I realized like, oh, wait a minute, that might be late for them. But like the fact that you were game was like, meant a lot.
Night owls.
We're fine.
We would have been smashing some
Netflix. Okay, you're night owls. That's good.
Absolutely fine. But we're so, so grateful that you've taken the time to talk to us from across the world. Yeah. And it's kind of surreal that we even have the opportunity to do this in this time. So we're so, so happy to have you.
Isn't it great what technology can do, right?
Oh, it's amazing. Unreal. Unreal.
So, so good. Yeah. So on that, you've been saying you've got some downtime, obviously. Do you have any arts recommendations for us at the moment?
So it's really funny because I haven't watched as, I should say, I haven't watched as many arts things per se. What I've been doing is actually been watching documentaries because I love understanding how people tick. And so literally this weekend, I watched the Tony Robbins documentary that you might have heard of. And they go through a seminar that he does usually in Palm Beach. And I was very inspired by how he changed people's lives and his story about how he became a motivational speaker. I'm just about to watch David Foster's documentary. So I like being able to sit down and kind of figure out what makes these people tick. And that's very exciting for me. That gets me very interested. You know, as far as arts recommendations, I just have not been like looking at any musicals. I will say like there's some great streaming services out there. Broadway HD has become really significant in the marketplace. Broadway On Demand is a big thing right now. And so you have all of these kind of interesting outlets where people are sharing knowledge. And I think it's really incredible. And I know that Hamilton is coming out tomorrow.
Yes, we're very excited about that.
It's a very exciting thing, and it's a first. Actually, that's not true because Legally Blonde it came out while I was playing on Broadway. But this is significant in a time where obviously we're not able to go to the theater. So to have that has been really nice. But I think it does reinforce the fact that artists are so essential. I don't know what's going on in Australia, but we are here in the United States. We are asking for arts relief beyond August 1st. And so, you know, one of the key points is like, it's happening in everybody's backyard. And I think the arts are so powerful and bring in so much in the US economy. I don't know how it is over there, but certainly it has an effect. So it's been interesting to kind of see how people are adapting in this new world of technology and sharing their knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just as important in Australia, absolutely. And there needs to be more funding for the arts here too. So, yeah, that's great to hear that you're fighting for arts relief. What's the sort of general vibe and feeling with people in the arts industry at the moment? Are you rallying together?
Well, you know, I think it's different for everybody. I think everybody's trying to figure out how to pivot, right? Because we have these skills, especially for people who do this for a living. And I would consider myself one of those people who, you know, we do this for a living. This is our life's calling. And that gets taken away from you. And it's like, what now? I've been fortunate where I've been involved in certain businesses in theater that are not directly related to a show. So I've certainly learned a lot from that. I have other interests, but it's figuring out how you are able to pivot. And I think a lot of people are starting to figure that out, whether it's classes. There have been a lot of my friends who have just gone out and done projects that basically they would charge a fee, but would be helping the next generation do certain things, like whether it's self-tape auditions, which is like a big thing now for auditioning, because you can't even go to the casting offices, or, you know, being able to do dance auditions, stuff like that. So there are a lot of these sort of self-help courses that have been pretty significant, I'd say, and are kind of changing the game of how we do business. And casting directors are holding seminars online. And, you know, Zoom is such a powerful thing. So the possibilities are endless. But I think people are starting to figure out, what else can I do? And and if there's anything about the theater community, in times of hardship, people do come together. People do figure things out. You know, I think a lot of people have been focused on the whole Black Lives Matter issue in the past, I guess, several weeks. But I think what's been interesting is when we got the announcement about Broadway closing, a lot of people started coming out with news like, I'm going to be doing this for the next few months, you know, in a way to help other people, but also see if they could make income. I think there's a way of doing that where it kind of bridges the line of helping people and also being able to help yourself.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. We get resourceful and innovative for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's even just in our circumstance, you know, the podcast was always a thing we thought about after Whopper. But then coming into this time, we were like, why don't we just do it now? Like, what's holding us back?
Right.
And people have been so generous with their time and so beautiful about it because, you know, we're all helping each other and we've got that downtime. It's really been awesome for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what you guys are doing is such an incredible responsibility because you are bringing on people who can give information or at least providing a space where that can happen. And I commend you for that. I think that's a really great thing at this time. So
Thank you. Well, we'd love to have a couple of fun questions before we get into the crux of the interview. And one we'd like to ask is there a theater experience that has really changed you as an artist or say producer?
Oh, it's a hard one because I've had many, but I think seeing the producers on Broadway was pretty significant. Watching Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, their performances were just so timeless, and it's pretty incredible to think that I got to experience that. And their comedy was amazing. One other experience and one of the first shows I ever saw on Broadway was The Music Man, which was directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman. Susan Stroman was also the director and choreographer of The Producers. And she at one time had 5 shows running on Broadway, including this one called A Christmas Carol, which I was fortunate enough to do that literally that next year. And I saw The Music Man and I was looking at the kid who played Winthrop and I was like, I want to do this. And there seems to be a habit in my life where if I say I want to do this, somehow it happened when I was a kid. It happened when I was wanting to be in a recording group. And it happened when I saw this amazing Music Man on Broadway. And who would have thought a year later I would be working with Susan Stroman. And that was kind of the pinch me moment of like, this is such a small world and anything can happen if you can set your mind to it. And I think The Music Man definitely gave me the understanding that this is something I want to do. As an actor at the time, and certainly now I branched out to being a producer, but it really gave me a love for theater and what it stands for.
Yeah. I love stories like that. That's amazing.
Unreal.
Well, then sort of on the flip side of that, do you have any funny theater mishap stories that you've been a part of or that you've seen?
Oh, my goodness. The one that sticks out for me. So when we did A Christmas Carol on Broadway, there's a scene, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the whole Christmas Carol or if it's slightly different, but there's a scene at Fezziwig's ball. And this is kind of a thing that's in every version. But in our version of the show, it's sort of a younger Scrooge and Emily celebrating. It's a holiday party of sorts. And I'm one of the kids on this table kind of dancing along. It's a me and this other kid were dancing on the table. And there's a moment where one of the dancers is coming towards the table. And for some reason, I thought he was going to hit the table. And I take two steps back and all of a sudden I'm on my back. And it's the worst thing ever. And then about, I guess, like 5-10 seconds later, I'm able to get up somehow, still be able to act normal dancing on stage. And I'm feeling this slight pain. And there's dialogue, there's dialogue, there's dialogue, there's dialogue. And all of a sudden, the cast had to just bring me off stage. And I did like one final taboo. And then it like I was done for the performance. My understudy had to go on. But what really surprised me is that I actually was able to do the next show, which ironically was like 3 to 4 hours later, because that day we had like an 11, a 5, and an 8. It was one of those shows. It's a 90-minute show. And so somehow I was able to get like back on stage, you know, talk about determination and like having will, because you have to as a performer. I was like, I need to get back on that stage. And but it was one of the most crazy moments, and you can hear the audience gasp. But I just couldn't believe that I was able to like get through that. But man, you know, falling off the table on Broadway, you never forget that.
Wow.
You never do. Oh my gosh. Was your back okay? Was it? What had
happened? Oh, it was fine. I mean, you just felt like a jolt, but yeah, I mean, it felt fine for the most part. It was just sort of a shock, if anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my mom was in the audience and thinking like, do I have to go up there? And she's a doctor. And she's like, do I have to go up there to do anything? Oh. And it's like, and you know, she's like, I think he's handling himself fine. He's dancing on a Broadway stage. That's all he can do.
Yeah. So, we care about.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, wow. That was one for the memory books. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. So you were a performer before you
went
producing. So can you tell us a bit about that? What was the journey to producing?
Oh my God. It was particularly with that show because I've always had such respect for Susan Stroman. And that was just a dream of a show to be a part of. And there was one moment where I always knew I loved the behind the scenes aspect. I mean, it goes back to like what makes people tick, which is, I think, a theme that I kind of had and I still have, which is why I love kind of going from one thing to the other, being a producer and an actor. But the thing was, there was a rehearsal where I was watching the dancers and how Susan Stroman was working with them. And I thought to myself, at some point, I kind of like to be behind the table and just be able to be part of that process. And I was really taken by it. And I just loved the idea of creating something. As an actor, you get to see it. And in some ways, you are naive at first, and then you build a little bit of an understanding of how it works. But I think over the years, I was always just fascinated by what a producer did. And so that kind of led me to, you know, getting into that more within, you know, I'd say the past 5-6 years of my life. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Wow.
And I think it was a progression over time. You know, being an actor, you know, have the understanding of what it is you do, but it leaves you curious. And, you know, it's funny. I have so many friends who are actors who want to get into producing because they see what that's like and they're fascinated. And it's a way of branching out. I think in this business, you can't just do one thing. You have to kind of excel at so many different things in order to survive. And so for me, I was just fascinated by the behind the scenes aspect. I had one person, I think, in like I went to a camp, an acting camp, and they're like, he's going to be a director one day. But I understood like what that, the kind of where that, you know, thinking was because I was trying to see visually. And I always had a, you know, I think it's important if you're a producer to always have a vision. And so, you know, I think that for me was the progression of having been an actor and understanding that side of it and going into producing. And it's like, what is my purpose? Why am I, you know, producing the show?
Yeah, amazing. So let's talk about Hadestown.
All right.
I've just been listening to it today and I absolutely adore the music.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So how did you hear about the show and then how did you come to be a producer on it?
It's such a funny story. So New York Theater Workshop was producing the New York premiere of the show back in 2017. Mm-hmm. It was in the round. So it's completely different from the show that's currently on Broadway. And I had a friend in it. His name was Patrick Page, who is doing the role now as Hades and just killing it. And I'm just super thrilled for him because he sought the project out. Apparently, he saw something in the trades and said, are they interested in me? And in fact, they came back and said, indeed, they are. And so he's been with that process for a long time. And, you know, I think what's interesting about the show was the themes of equality, the themes about the wall. Like at that time, candidate Trump was really gaining momentum. And so it hit a chord in a big way. I mean, the end of Act One, I stood out of my seat and I was like, oh my God. This material really resonates. And I think Act Two really got me. And I'm not going to give any spoilers. But after that, I had drinks with Patrick and we were talking. And he said, do you think this could go like to A Circle in the Square, which was in the Round Theater at the time? And I didn't feel like that was the right move, but I knew they were still working on it. And I think cut to that next year, because all this was like 2016, 2017. There was a workshop at New 42, which is a rehearsal studio in New York, and they made it a proscenium show, that Rachel Chafkin, the director, was able to kind of, make use of. And I was really blown away by it. And I thought this has the elements of being a really great Broadway show. And I would say a couple of months later, because it looked like they were capitalized. So I thought, well, you know, they're not going to need me going forward. That I had a friend who knew the lead producer and said, oh, they're still raising money. And this was before Broadway was ever announced. This was, must have been, God, yeah, it was probably like two years ago. And I said, oh my God, can you put me in touch? Because I've been trying to get a hold of the team. And I get connected with the lead producer. We have a wonderful lunch. I really fall in love with the kind of person she is as a lead producer. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm really motivated to be part of this. And that's how it happened.
That is incredible. And then how did it feel to be a producer on that show and then to be nominated and win so many Tony Awards?
Well, you know, you never know how these things are going to go, right? And I think... Listen, it's such a blessing to be part of a show that obviously resonates because three times out of four, sometimes it doesn't have that, you know, that lightning effect. And when a show does, you're lucky to be in the room. I'm really glad that I believed in it since like 2016 when I saw it at New York Theater Workshop. And then I sort of stuck with it because there were moments where I could have just said, I'm going to give up on this. And I think timing is everything, being at the right place at the right time. And so this team, it just made sense. Because I remember when we were in London and the reviews were coming in and people were very happy, but nobody really knew. I think London was doing okay sales wise, but it wasn't like the kind of thing like New York where we've been selling out every night, you know, in the past year. And so you obviously have these feelings of like, will it work? Will theater owners get excited? I've been excited about the project. It's built in progress. Like everything is going, but you really can't tell unless you have an audience that you're talking to or friends. And I remember specifically one of the final previews on Broadway. I had a colleague of mine come see the show and she literally looked at me and said, I'm obsessed. And that moment to me, for somebody that had no idea what the show was, maybe knew one or two people on the show, including myself. And for her to say that was huge because, you know, as an artist, understanding what that is, I think what the team did a great job is sort of clarifying the story points as it went on. And it was just a validation for me that I made the right choice, that my instincts played well. Because as a producer, you really have to think about what you're getting yourself into. More meaning, what about the project is reeling you in? What's exciting you before, you know, you even sign on? So that was very gratifying. And obviously, Tony Knight, I mean, it was just amazing. And it's still surreal to even think that it happened. And it just went by so quickly. The night was amazing. It felt like we all were celebrating something that we accomplished together. And I'm just proud of the equity in our cast, what we stand for. We're really kind of been huge on the Black Lives Matter movement. There's been, I've been in protests with a lot of the company, which has been great. And I think we were one of the first Broadway shows to speak out, you know, when the news of George Floyd came. And I'm just proud of the messages we've been sending and what we've been doing as a family. So it's just been an amazing journey.
And I guess like it's a bit different when you're kind of picking up a new show, something that's going to be new to Broadway. But when you're kind of looking at older musicals, what's the kind of thought process behind that? Because that stuff that's already been seen by people. So yeah. Are you thinking, does this still speak to audiences today? Or is it just because it's a hit and you just know it's going to sell? What kind of things do you go through for the musicals that have already come and gone?
Well, I have a different philosophy on that. And it depends where you are in the world because some markets just work differently. I feel like revivals only have a certain shelf life unless they just radically change the game. I am a person who really wants to be involved with the new works. And the reason is because you have a shelf life that can go on for so long. And your investors can potentially make money for a longer period of time. Because once you have a show that's on Broadway that's new, the subsidiary rights, which means that a school could produce it, a regional theater can produce it, and there's a licensing fee that goes back to the original LLC, which is the limited liability company that's set up to put up the capitalization for the Broadway show. So it's this streaming sort of income that I think is an advantage. And I also think new musicals were telling a new story. Now, sometimes with revivals, if it harkens back on something that is important, sure. I just tend to like to do new musicals because I think there's more opportunity to grow and develop things with new material.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. And so in the process of kind of getting a cast together, how much power does a producer have? Because we kind of hear, you know, oh, when you get to like the final rounds, you've got like a super panel and there's like heaps of producers there and they're kind of say in who gets cast as well. So what's the reality of that?
So, well, I mean, for Hadestown, I'm a co-producer. So I did not have as much sway on the casting. I will say I'm very proud of what our team did and how they casted the show. You know, everybody comes from different backgrounds and it's incredible. And I've really been fortunate to get to know the cast within the last year. And it's the kind of thing I would be wanting to do as a lead producer, which means you're running everything. I think if you're a lead producer, you definitely have more sway in that. And like, I just did a reading not too long ago of a new play that I'm developing. And one of the things I was very conscious of is how we are doing casting. And I was really lucky to have collaborators who we were all on the same page working together. And I feel it's so important that if a producer can be involved in those final decisions in being able to kind of put the family together with the creative team, it's such an important thing because it establishes how you put that family together. And it's sort of a process. The way I kind of look at it is you're building a house. So if you want to make sure that the furniture is right, that the lights are put in a certain way, you want to be involved in every step of that process. And as a lead producer, you're able to do that. So I think, yeah, we certainly do. I think more and more as you get to kind of the top, as if you're a gatekeeper, certainly, you definitely have that sway in terms of leading your production. And but you want to trust your creative team. And I stress that because they are going to have their ideas. And sometimes you may not be in sync, but you understand, you have to understand what, where they're coming from and what their vision is. And so that's a discussion in itself, but it really is a collaborative process to say the least.
Mm. Yeah. Wow.
I love how you say family, putting your family together.
Yes.
That's so beautiful.
It's not just a machine.
No.
Because sometimes it can be painted out to be some kind of machine. And maybe that's more of a thing for Australia, because by the time it comes to us, it's we're kind of, you know, for the bigger commercial shows, what we tend to hear is that we're recreating what was on Broadway.
Yeah.
And usually that's the case. Yeah. If you're going international. Yeah. That you're right. It's usually the case. And one of the big things that happens is that you will have what the show is. I know, like 9 to 5, for example, it was going to be coming to Australia, and I was associate producer in the London production. And when we announced that, it's like it's fitting into the mold, but it's also being able to take your brilliance as performers and artists and kind of mold it into what we've created. Because that's you're right. That's usually what happens. And so you are working in that kind of sphere that's being worked. It is that that playbook that we made in the original. And sometimes it can be adapted to be different. I know that there, you know, certain shows, from what I understand, they've made changes, you know, to adapt to audiences where you guys are. And so that's an advantage. But I think at the end of the day, it's taking the talent and being able to say, how can we use this to kind of give the show that was in New York, but get into Australia or any other country, et cetera.
Yeah, amazing. And I look at going back to casting and how you go about that. Again, I feel like in Australia, we mainly do shows that have trickled down from London or Broadway. So there's a certain way that casting sort of needs to be done.
Right. And
I don't know. I feel like as Australia, we're not ready yet to have like a person of color as Elsa or Anna. I feel like the climate here, I feel like I wouldn't go for a role right now in Australia that isn't outside of the ethnic person or the person of color. But on Broadway, I see it happening everywhere. And there is a woman of color in Frozen and people of color in all sorts of shows. And I feel like where you are, it doesn't really matter what you look like. It matters what story you have to bring.
Right. It matters if you can play the role. And I think that's so important to, and I'm sorry to hear that because obviously I think with this whole Black Lives Matter movement, if there's anything that I think is positive out of this, it'll push theater to hopefully where the gatekeepers can also be of equal. There's equality there. We can have different voices at the table. One of the big things that I think you just made me think about this was I've had so many actors of color come to me and say, I want to produce. I want to get behind the table and be involved in this change. And I said, well, you can. It's putting your... it's a way of putting, you know, your ideas out there and being in the right place at the right time. And if people like me can facilitate that, I think that's only positive. But getting to you, I think to the point about diversity and equity over where you are. I think it will get to that point once they see what's happening on Broadway, because they can't really, you know, put up a show in Australia and not recognize the significance of that. And I think there are going to be more shows where we're going to see even more equity, because I think producers want to make progressive change. And so I think, you know, once it starts in one country, and this is just my belief, and I could be totally wrong about this, but I think once it starts in one country, it'll eventually get to others. Because it's like you are setting the show and it, what it is, and you're using the best talent you possibly can. So, you know, that's my belief.
That's exciting.
That's really exciting.
Hopeful to hear.
Mm.
Yeah, that's really hopeful to hear.
Sure.
So you have produced on Broadway, and then you've also produced on the West End as well. What was the difference between producing?
Well, your capitalization is always less. You know, there are not as many unions involved in London, which, you know, is a positive and negative in some ways. But, you know, your costs are cheaper. I find, you know, in the West End, one of the biggest things is that they love Americana. And that's a really cool thing. 9 to 5 was a really interesting idea because it had not done as well on Broadway. I think people had written it off because it just wasn't the success they were hoping for. Meanwhile, you have a version in London that's just killing it, that did incredibly well at the box office and has an album that everybody is talking about now. So it's, I think wherever you play these shows, there's just a difference in audience and culture. And so that was a big difference between Broadway and the West End in some ways. And you'll find that revivals tend to work in some ways better in the West End and in London. And so I find that just very interesting in itself. And you're also, you know, I think the big stars, usually, you know, the pay is slightly different from America just because of the union stuff. But they're treated really well in London in a certain way, where it's a slightly different in the States. But the pay usually is better in the States. So I found that to be very interesting. But, you know, I think overall, what I find just fascinating is there's just a variety of things in the West End, from plays to musicals. But I think there's certainly this Americana factor that I think most people would take for granted, that people in London and the UK love. So that's been a very interesting thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Would you ever come and produce in Australia?
Yeah, I think if it's the right project, of course. And I think you guys have an incredible theater market for sure. I was actually hearing that, like, all, I know that I think Hamilton's coming to Australia, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. So you have some equity, you know, coming your way. But I think what's really important is that, like, you guys are starting to grow. I've like seen how, like, the different shows are coming in. So, yeah, I think it's the right project. It's always, you want to find something that's cost effective, that's going to make its money. But I think in, like, certain cities, if you get certain cities that would work, I think there's always a way of having a success over there. So I'm always open to it.
Cool.
Yeah.
And when you say cost effective and is going to work, what do you look for?
Like, I look at running costs. Yeah. I look at running costs for something like that, you know, how much, you know, how long will it take to recoup, which means return money to the investors. So that takes a certain amount of time. And, you know, looking at the future, like, where does it want to go? You know, do you have the rights just in Australia, or do you want to develop it to become something else and take it somewhere else? I would be fascinated, obviously, if their original musical is coming from Australia, and I don't feel like that's far off. I think you guys have so many resources to do that. You know, with tours, like, if Hadestown should come to Australia, of course I'd be a part of that, because I think it would be an incredible expansion of the brand. So, you know, but you have to think about these things before you go on shows, only in the sense that you want to serve your investors well and have a successful ride at it, you have to look at all of those factors. So that's just like one of the things I always try to look at, you know, whether international or in the States.
And when you're looking at these things, I guess, how did you learn to be a producer and know about these things and where you're going to recoup money or lose money?
Oh my God.
No.
Well, the truth is you like keep learning consistently because the business changes so much. I don't think there's ever a time where you're like, this is a set thing, you know, for sure. I mean, listen, nobody really thought Hadestown was going to be the hit it was. Let's be honest. I mean, it was developed for almost 10 years. But it got to where it was because of the work of an incredible creative team. I think the key for me is like, you have to love the show. That's like the first thing. And you have to know that the team is doing a good job in keeping everything tight and that they're doing a good job telling the story. Then you have to look at the financials and see if it makes sense. You know, can it make its money back? And I think that's over time accruing skills and also kind of taking storybook examples of shows that may not have worked, textbook examples, I should say, of shows that may not have worked and what their faults were. I think it's a learning experience in just so many ways, but I always try to look for shows that that are not too expensive, but are at that price range where you actually have a chance of making your money back. And I think that's such an important thing. But I think taste is like number one. You have to have a taste palate. And Hadestown from the get-go definitely was part of that.
It's kind of like that gut feeling. You just know you're going to do it. Yeah.
I certainly felt that in 2016, and I felt that when I saw the workshop in 2017. And so there are a lot of good feelings about it.
I think a show like Hadestown, that's what I see more emerging from Broadway and the West End, those kind of shows that sound soulful, a bit contemporary, with a smaller cast. It's not about the big glitz and glam and the jazz hands, and we're wanting a more sort of intimate theater experience, I think, with shows like Face Down and The Band's Visit. And it's exciting.
No, I think I love that you say that because I think intimacy is the key. That's how you tell a good story. And don't get me wrong. I think like the splashy musicals do make an impact, but most of the time you'll find, you know, on average, they may not make their money back on Broadway. And so these intimate musicals, it's great. It's good financials, but it's also good storytelling. And that's what I really loved about Hadestown. And that's why I'm like so fortunate that it's been doing as well as it has. And, you know, we'll go on tour in North America and others, you know, as they're announced. But I think the show serves well anywhere you can put it because it's that kind of show where the simplicity of it works in its favor. And I do love those kind of shows. I try to be involved with those kind of shows that I know are going to have an impact on people, but are really about bringing people into the theater.
That's so cool.
Beautiful.
So
nice. And it's so nice to hear that Australia is very much considered in terms of, you know, places to go and produce shows. Because I guess, like, you know, Broadway and West End are like, you know, hubs for that stuff. But I think we're really trying to make that happen here, especially in Melbourne. So,
Well, didn't you guys have like Book of Mormon recently? You've had Aladdin. You've had a few things come in your way.
Yeah, we have actually. Yeah.
You're not schlepping by any means. I mean, it's incredible.
And we're getting there. We were going to have Frozen. So you're right.
Yeah.
Definitely the commercial musicals are definitely coming our way. Anyway, so that was so good, and just a world that Georgia and I really don't know about, and probably a lot of performers just don't even think beyond, you know, the rehearsal room, and there's so much prep that happens before.
Right.
It's insane. Some questions we'd love to ask you to wrap up is there any advice that you would have given to or would like to give to your younger self now, having been through all of these experiences?
It's funny because I think the first thing I would tell anybody is, who are you as an artist? Really try to define that. And it doesn't have to be exact right now, but try to figure out who you are as an artist and what you stand for, because that brings you to the projects that you're meant to be a part of. You know, I think one piece of advice is just to go with the flow of everything, because you just never know what's going to happen. Don't expect too much. But, you know, be prepared to be disappointed, but also that will make you even feel more happy when the highs are there. So, you know, essentially you're working hard, you know, to get to your goal. And when that thing happens, it's almost like a wonderful, pleasant surprise. You know, you want to be prepared for that moment when that does come, and then you can ride on that, is what I'm saying. And, you know, be yourself. You know, there's only one of you in the world. And I feel like sometimes we can try to emulate somebody else or want to be somebody else, especially for actors out there. I would just say, you know, you're going into an audition room. The biggest thing the casting director wants to see is what you bring to the table. What I want to see is what you bring to the table, because when I'm looking at a casting list and I know some of these people, I'm like, I know this person can bring this. I know they're capable of doing this. This is really good for this particular role. And that's a discussion that I feel, you know, actors should be knowing about. And I think that's one of the things, you know, I didn't mention this earlier, but I think the advantage of being, having been an actor, is being a producer, I understand in quite a number of ways what the actors are going through. And I can get on their level and say, like, no, I get it. You know, you want to try to go for this kind of role because that serves you as a human, as an actor. That's who you are. And I think, you know, being vulnerable and understanding who you are is so important in this business. So never shy away from that.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Beautiful. Mm. Yeah. And then what are your hopes for the industry in the future on Broadway specifically?
Oh, my goodness. I think having more young people at the helm. You know, and look, Broadway has been amazing. I'm grateful for all the mentors, all the colleagues I've met. I think in typical fashion, it's always been a boys' club in some ways. And I think that has to change, but that's going to be an evolution. And that's not going to happen overnight. I think having people in leadership positions of all different backgrounds, I think, is really important. Because I think it's good for everybody to be able to tell their stories. And I think, you know, more new works. I mean, I think, you know, you were mentioning the idea of revivals and bringing that. And obviously, in some ways, that's a great cash cow for a short amount of time. But I think the longevity of a good musical is just as powerful, and even more so, in my opinion. So I think, let's create new works. Let's get down and dirty.
Yeah. Wow.
I love it.
Let's get down
and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us. It's been such a joy, and we've learned so much.
Yeah. Oh my God. Tiana and Georgia, it's my pleasure. And thank you for having me.
We hope you guys enjoyed that interview as much as us. We were honestly just filled with the warm and fuzzies. He's just so kind. And it was just,
we totally were. I felt like a bit of a school kid just sitting there and listening to all he had to say, because I have absolutely no reference point for what it's like to be a producer on Broadway or on the West End. And he was just so generous with what he had to say. And we both loved how he referred to his companies in the various musicals that he's been a part of as his family. And when they're casting, they look for family. That really stuck with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a fun fact, at one point during that interview, Georgia and I could actually, we were sitting at Whopper because it was really late at night, and we thought, great, no one will be here. But there was some MT girl, and I would love you to tell us who you are, who was belting out Name some mean shame. Girls during the interview. And it was so funny. But then, you know, it quieted down after that. But yeah.
Look, go off. I'm sure she wasn't expecting us to be there at 10:30 at night during the podcast.
And props to you for being able to sing that well.
To belt at 10:30. Seriously, I'm in bed usually. It's great.
Yeah, but
it's very apt.
But back to the interview. It was so good. And we'd love to hear your feedback. So let us know what you thought.
And thank you so much to Jonathan Tamar again. What an absolute legend. Thanks for joining us this week on Company. If you enjoyed this episode with Jonathan, please let us know on our Facebook or Instagram at Company Pod. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can find Jonathan on Twitter and Instagram at Jonathan Tamar.
Big shout out to our producing guru, Douglas Rintel, media queen Deirdre Koo, also known as Deedle Dum Designs, and David Duquedis on music. Catch you next time.
Ciao.